a story about a mosque I know. When it comes to big girls, she steals the show. Ain't exactly pretty, ain't exactly a smile. 55, 36, 50 pounds, you can say she's got it all.
All right, folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 podcast. Jay Bird.
Oh, a lot of Muskie, Steve.
Yes!
Yeah.
You went from Bon Scott to Little John. Anyway,
what 52, 54, 55. Hello.
From the window to the wall. To a fish with Stephen Paul. Anyway, so
Yeah. What else is going on, Steve?
My goodness. It's Sunday. It's fun day.
Yes, sir.
I have been out on the water with the Farkas of Marks, which is Martin Farkas.
I know him.
He's a great dude. He comes up to the store. We've been fishing our butts off. Been catching fish. It's a weird deal. I'll tell you what. Down south, it is a mixed up bag of mix uppery, Jay.
How so?
Hot, cold, mixed, just everything. Like frontal systems. You got pre-spawn, you got post-spawn, you got spawning, you got fish that don't know what year it is. So it's a grab bag of funsies. Just dip your toes, wade out in the water, Jay. Wade out a little bit deeper. I thought, for sure, going to the Netherlands, hanging out with team would satiate that problem. It would be a misnomer this year. I would avoid it. Nope, smack dab right there, and it stuck in the middle with you. Steelers will, Jay. Now, one of my favorite movie scenes is Tarantino. Steelers will. You know exactly what I'm talking about, don't you?
Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Speaking of beautiful video editing, cinematography, if you will. Musky photography. Indubitably. Jay, you just sent me the beautiful edit you did on the first leg of the pike trip. What are you thinking there, bud?
Yeah. Big Netherlands pike, you talking?
Yeah. What do you think?
Cool little video. Got some cool content. Got some big monster pike and some tactics and some new things to do with the Kraken. And you kind of let the cat out of the bag on a couple of those new tail options that are going to change things for the better.
Well, the next video, I think we played with, I'll just tell podcast people. There's only four people listen, Jay. Me, you, my mother, and my wife. That's the only people listen. We just do that. We've done this for this many years, hoping we would gain traction, Jay. One of these days, Jay,
we would gain traction.
Jay, yeah, are you listening to me, buddy?
Yeah, I'm there.
We're gonna take off one of these days, me and you,
to the moon, baby.
To the moon. Just keep doing.
I don't know
it.
What that means.
I'm thinking only 400 more episodes and people really pick up on this.
Okay,
it's me and you. Okay. Maybe we got it wrong. Let's try it again from the top. Hi. I'm Steve,
and I'm Jay,
and welcome to the Muskie Shop. We've got new baits. They're exciting baits. They're good baits. Let us provide you with your baits. Let us be your bait people. Jay, how's your model trains?
Model trains.
You know,
I know what you're talking about.
I'm here. I'm selling baits. Whatever. Oy vey. So, you know, one of the, Jay, we're going to hit it big someday, bud.
Okay.
Just keep dreaming. So last week we almost had 5 listeners. Almost. I gave this bum a hamburger and he almost listened.
Well, I'm glad you're crunching the stats there, Steve. It means a lot to me.
I don't even know what we're talking about, boys. I'm so neck deep in these Pepsis, I can't see. But too many Pepsis too dark to see. But, yeah, me and Jay are going to hit off one of these days. We'll get it. We'll get the right recipe here to get people to listen. Hi, Mom. Okay. Say hi to my mom, Jay.
Oh, Mama Paul. Hey, hi.
Paul. Our number one and only listener.
Well, anyone. Say, when all my dad listens, say hi to my dad,
your
Steve.
Your dad. Hey, Jay's dad. Hey, dad. What's up, dad?
You've met him.
Mm-hmm. He said you were a huge disappointment. Anyway, so there's new stuff at the Muskie Shop this week. So Meps is running a special. It's not because they want to get rid of them, because they can do special things because they're Meps.
It's because I can't buy them fast enough.
Listen.
Oh my gosh, we're selling a ton of them.
Tell the people to sell, and maybe you'll regain your dad's love, Jay. What's going
on? Well, the entire month of April, all Meps Muskie Killers. Are you kidding me? Muskie Killers, Baitfish Series Muskie Killers, and the Tandem Muskie Killers, 15% off. So they're on the top of the website. Dang. In the new section. Moving like crazy. If a color sold out, hold on a couple days. We're getting more in.
It's like Eddie Money. Baby, hold on to me.
Surely.
Muskie, hold on to me.
Muskie, hold on to me.
Whatever will be, will be.
The trolling is harsh to see.
What's the horrible song here with the sax solo in it?
That I did?
You play sax. Jay plays saxophone, everybody.
Duh. Yeah.
Next week, Jay's going to do the intro where it's just me and him doing Careless Whisper.
You know who played sax on that song?
Who? No.
I don't know. George, I'm just asking.
I think George Michael did it himself.
No.
He blew something. I don't know if it was a saxophone. Anyway, so we've got
there
the
you go with
sales.
The jokes again. Yeah, we got the meth sale.
Mm-hmm. It just mm-hmm. whatever. I read the
it
news.
Is what it is.
I read the news today.
Oh boy.
God.
Hey, you know what else came in?
Oh,
you know what? It's starting to come in. Are the RJ78 bucktail? Got
RJ.
The first 8 colors in. Those are going to be hard to get this year. He's struggling with making baits fast enough. So
is that the weight forward model?
No.
Okay.
No.
Just the straight.
Straight bucktail with 1.7 and 1.8 Colorado blade and hair body.
Mix them up.
Pretty airbrush.
Get crazy. Yeah. Beavers are back, boys. It's beaver season.
Sink
your teeth
that?
Into them, boys.
Yep.
Wet your whistle.
Yep. It's latex lures. Season. Those are quickly getting demolished, but we've still got decent supply left of latex.
Are they
topwater
are
baits
people
too?
Demolishing the beavers?
They are. Yep. I'm not going to say it. And eventually we're going to get some more Steve's Tailgater spinner baits in too.
I'm going to
get refilled
down.
On those. They're almost sold out
once
again.
Once you got the there's a couple. Shad Daddy. There's a couple colors that are out.
Okay.
So you got those, you know, I mean, goodness is gracious. Lake X, it's one of these baits where we get them when we get them at the Muskie Shop. We try good. We try hard, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you need one, or if you suspect you're going to need one later in the summer, get her now.
It's kind of the advice best taken.
So you never know. Again, it is what it is. Making baits is hard. Making baits is hard to do. So, that's it, Jay. What's your tips on mini beavers?
On the mini beaver, get a weight kit, buy a phantom weight or a Suic weight kit, and those will screw in there because you need to add weight to that bait. And they have inserts for weights. Much needed. Get that thing run properly.
There you go.
Jason. Otherwise, it's extremely buoyant, and it stays very high in the water column without added weight.
And the XL beaver, same thing?
Yipper.
14-inch beaver, 5.9-ounce.
Got some of the XL, not the XL, the, what do they call it, the Lake Edition. He's starting to make some of those again. Got some of them in the standards.
Like, what's this?
So Lake Edition has, it's pre-weighted, and there's no insert for it. So it's going to run pretty sweet.
12 inches, 5 inches. That's a sweet beaver.
Yep.
That's the one you want.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Anyway. Get squared up on that. No, Jay was talking about the big pike vid coming up. We're super stoked about that. Something else that's kind of goofy. Just a new thing here.
Okay.
Jambalaya himself, probably a mistake because we're idiots, said, why don't we put the podcast on the website for the Muskie Shop? So if let's say you're having problems, you can't get the app or you don't have it on Apple or whatever it is, the podcast is now on themuskyshop.com. So you can check that out. And every episode will have a transcript, unfortunately, Jay.
Okay.
So everything you said has been written down.
In which language?
It's like having a stenographer.
Okay.
So when we argue, now I have the written text that shows you're wrong. Think about that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Now you got to read it back and I go, listen, this is what you said to me and this is what hurt my feelings.
This is what hurt my feelings. Well, there's more coming with that, you know. Oh boy. I don't know. It's just, you know.
There's more where that came from.
Stay seated because the night is young, Steve.
You know, you have no regard for, listen, Jay, you only think about yourself, really.
They call me automatic whiplash. I don't know why, but, you know. Hey, Fred called a little bit ago, too. He said Savage Gears are flying out of here, and we don't even have the new ones in yet. And he just called me for, like, an update while he was leaving work tonight.
We'll call Fred.
He's on his way to Anago tomorrow. So, no,
to see this. And,
well, I don't know, but he said, hey, if I need to pick up the Suic order, let me know. So I'm going to contact Mike Suic in the morning and see if it's ready to be picked up. And then Fred save my time, and then they don't have to ship it.
Imagine if Fred's just in the parking lot tonight.
He's been known to hang out there sometimes. So,
and loiter?
Then loiter, yeah.
Well, so what, we'll Savage, see what, happens. What Savage Gear's flying out?
He wasn't sure. He couldn't put it into words.
That's hella info, dude.
That is just telling it like it is. I said, which model,
that's
man?
Amazing.
And he said, I think the foreplays have been going by. The foreplays and the perch baits. And I said, okay, well, that's good to know. We got more of those on order coming in this week, too.
Well, that's the hot tip for the Antigo Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Anyway, goodness gracious. I'll tell you what, I got a text from a Smitty this week.
Did you?
Yeah, they were down. They trespassed across my land.
What, they've been there on vacation too, or what's going on?
They went down south, right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
And didn't know what a biscuit was. And that's it. I had no clue. They just showed up, went bass fishing. I have proof on my phone. The Smitties went bass fishing.
All right.
Slightly embarrassing. But nonetheless, a bunch of people wrote in. They're going, what's up with the Smitty Diamond file where we're kind of, maybe it was me, maybe it was you, I'll blame you, where we were riffing on it and they go, what's the difference between the two files? Because the Smitty file is super popular, right?
Yeah.
They're flat file. You go to the Muskie Shop, there's a busket, Jay, a busket of them by the register. Not a bucket, a busket. But the diamond file has this groove in the center. So if you're fishing single hook bait, that is a super important tool to have. Like your spinner baits, like your meat grinders, your tailgaters, your top, not top or slop raiders,
slop masters,
whatever, man. Raider. Rad dogs, sad dogs, mad dogs, whatever they are.
Right.
Rad, bad, sad, mad. That's going to be a great file for that. And it's a different, like we talked about, we covered it, but a lot of people are like, what do you mean?
Yeah, so you're saying it's not blinged out. It has a performance feature to it.
No, people are going like, why? Yeah, yes. Jake, please make me a blinged out file. You just said that. I demand a Smitty file with a blinged out handle now.
How cool.
Where it's just a typical Smitty file, but it has jewels in it, like a Kardashian. Yeah. It's not that it's a diamond edition. It is a diamond, like, basically diamond dust. Dusty roads. That is better for sharpening stainless steel. So, yes, one file is great, but if you're fishing, like, you know, your stainless steel hooks or what's the hooks, Jay, that are like, and I'm going to, the terminology I'm going to screw it up, but like, they look galvanized. Some of the saltwater hooks are like the gray material.
Yeah, yeah. I think they call them tin, but I don't know what they're composed of. Maybe it's cheap stainless steel or something. I don't know.
But you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. That are a hardened steel. The Smitty diamond file is really good on those chaos hooks we talked about. I don't know if we got there last week. I was kind of running my mouth, as always, in a shocking twist.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the Medusas or the current production where they have these really thick hook shanks. Well, guess what happens? People go, the hook's been out, right? They think they caught a 50-pounder and they caught the bottom of the lake, right? Hook. So manufacturers respond, they get heavier hooks, and it's this like dichotomy of response and retaliation, and you end up with the most ridiculous hooks ever that are hard to sharpen. That Smitty diamond file is excellent because it contours down the back of the hook, so the two, if you will, there's two metal bars that have diamond shavings or diamond dust on them, right? And you draw them down just like your normal hook file, but it's way, way easier to get a great point on super hard material. So your stainless steel hooks, your tin hooks, as Jay said, or galvanized hooks, or whatever you want to look at them, whatever you want to call them, that is the money sharpener. That's clarification sakes there, you know?
Cool. Yeah.
And then Jay's proud to announce our new sponsor this week.
We have a new sponsor, Steve.
The Smitty Legal Fund.
Oh, that's right.
Right. You can donate today to the Smitty Legal Fund. Jay,
being indicted?
Not yet. It's not an indictment in Minocqua, they say. It was
seizure?
No, when the guy was doing the news thing, and he's like, oh, what did he say? When he's doing, the guy was like, arrangement.
They've been arranged.
It was, we were watching the Minocqua news, and he said it was supposed to be an arrangement. An arraignment.
Yeah, that was about the guy that found the Menards gift card in the dumpster.
Of destiny. Any update on that?
I've been watching, and no, there isn't, man. I'm going to let you know.
Can you Google that real quick? I'm going to look real quick.
I've tried. Nothing comes up.
Well, has he been arranged yet?
Okay. Was it Minocqua or was it Eagle River? Do you remember what town it was in?
I don't know. I've had multiple people ask me who did that voice. Like, oh, that was funny. Who did that? That was the news. That's who did that. The news. Not me, not Jay. It was so dumb. It was a podcast intro. So he's been arranged. Anyway. So something I want to touch on that it's just par for the course this time. You know what I'm saying? It's up and down. It's crazy. It's this. It's that. I've gotten texts. I've gotten emails. There is a certain cutoff period for the spawn, which is not temperature driven. It is photo period driven. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm dealing with kooky temps. Right? you know, it snowed in the North Woods. Jay thought it was ice is over, and here we are clear and free, and guess what? Snow and ice, right? I was wearing a float suit 2 days ago, and now I'm finally wearing jeans. It is a crazy temperature gradient. The answer is body of water section to section. So everyone, are they spawning or not? Guess what, Jay? What's the answer? Body somewhere. Of water section to section. It is going to be a mixed bag, a cornucopia of suffering for a hot minute, right? So if you're on a big body of water, the fish that are on the north end or the fish that have gone, it's going to be different everywhere you go. Definitely in the far south, we've missed kind of the window. Some are, some aren't, some haven't, some will. And I'm a crazy diligent record keeper where I've looked at my numbers and I go, ooh, this is reminiscent of a couple years where you're catching fish in late May that have eggs on them because they don't know what's happening, right? Jay, what are you seeing weather-wise? What's happening up there?
Looking good. Looking good. We've had 50s the last couple days and high wind today. So I'm assuming when I drive to work that the lakes are going to be completely ice-free, if not really close.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Well, hopefully it holds for a week. I haven't seen the long-range forecast, but there's no really bad cold weather in the near future. So right, this might be it. They might open up this week. And
well, there you
if that's the case, you know, hey, that's, you know, a couple weeks earlier than normal. So
well,
looking for a good season.
The last few years have been kooky, but you know, everywhere else, mixed bag. You know, whether it be Pennsylvania, New York, I've heard it all this week. People are going, what do I do? Virginia, everywhere in between. You've got to take it section by section. So areas that are getting the most sun, that are the warmest, Jay, guess what's happening? They're spawning. Sections of the lake that don't get as much saturation from sunlight. Maybe it crusts over a hill and it goes sick. You see what I'm saying? Like the duration of photo period is actually slightly different. Now, the overall arching part of the day is different, but you're seeing muskies paired up. You're seeing muskies that are predating, everything in between. So you've got to kind of address that and look at your situation. Now, what that's going to really boil down to, A, are we seeing fish? And B, where are bait fish staged? Right? That's going to be the main driver there. Shifting gears quickly, Jay. Next weekend, I will be in Toronto. That's Canada. Do you know that?
The Odyssey.
I will be at Muskie Odyssey in Toronto.
That's a big show.
It's the biggest on planet Earth. Do you know that?
Sounds like fun.
The entire Earth.
Very cool.
That's how we say it down here, Earth. It's annoying, isn't it? Earth. So that is the biggest show in the world, planet Earth. So Muskie Odyssey, I will be there next weekend. I was texting with Mike from Waterwolf, going to see him, going to see a bunch of people up there that are podcast fans and looking forward to it. Going to huck some books with me across the border there. Going to go up there and visit with everybody. If you're in the Toronto area, Jay, and you want to take me out for Pepsi's, call me. No, if you want to go to that show, just look up Muskie Odyssey. It's coming up. Very excited about that. I'm going to do a big seminar. We're going to cover muskie structure fishing.
There you go.
Last week, I alluded, I said, we're going to talk about the details of structure fishing, which I'm going to in a minute, right? Going to here in a second. But I was going to let Jay talk a little bit more about some of the shorts and the rattle hog. What you got going on here, buddy?
Oh, the rattle hog?
Yeah. You got that's the article. Kind of a... I need to take a drink. I need to carry the show for like 60 seconds.
Oh, I'm begging. Well, I'll try.
I'm throwing you softballs here, buddy.
Well, I was looking through my videos from this last season, and I'm like, you know what? That rattle hog really needs to be on there because actually when Steve saw that in the water, he was thoroughly impressed. And I remember Jim Stewart throwing it when we were on the Eagle River chain. And we had, four guys in the boat. Very, very strange, hard, cold front conditions. Needless to say, fish were shallow and in the slop. So a loud, noisy surface bait. you know, is the ticket, and bright colored stuff. But regardless, this rattle hog is made by Hog Seeker's Tackle. It's a wood bait. It's kind of, if you had to compare it to one bait, it would be like a husky hog wobbler, although this bait is straight and it's got a flap tail. It's very, very easy to work. You can put the rod tip up and get a pretty good tempo casting that thing back, and it's just got a great wiggle to it, and figure eights great. So you can drive the bait downward and in your figure eight at the boat side, and subsurface it works just as well. So
I just typed in Hog Seekers, HOGseekers.com, and went to your home address. What's up with that?
That's Fred's.
H-A-W-G.
Sure.
Okay, not Hog, H-O-G. Yeah,
you spelled it wrong. You spelled it right. Wrong, Steve. Come on, wake up.
Hog Seeker, not Hog Seeker. Anyway, so would you consider yourself to be a hog master, Jay?
Sure.
Fantastic. Anyway, let's talk structure detail. So I alluded to it last week. Gonna riff on this. I've pontificated. I've thought about it. I'm gonna kick my feet up here in the bait cave. Here they come. I have wet socks and cheap shoes on, Jay. I'm wearing my Walmart slip-ons because it's wet outside, and launching the boat. Got a gut full of Mexican food and cerveza. So structure fishing, if you haven't figured that out, is kind of the key to everything. What I was doing in the Netherlands, structure fishing, channels, offshore breaks, blah, 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 blah. You watch this video, Jay, there's not a shoreline in sight, is there?
No, half mile plus. Yeah,
we're just out there in the abyss, if you will, right?
Sure. So basically shipping lanes. Big water. It's as big as they get. Massive. I mean, this bay goes straight into the North Atlantic Ocean.
That's big. So what matters to fish is structure. So cover the very basics real quick. So cover and structure are exclusive elements. Weeds, timber, rocks. Rocks are kind of this weird thing, but weed, timber, those are not permanent, right? Those are not there forever. Therefore, they're not as important as structure. So good structure and the hierarchy is far more important than cover. Cover being timber, weeds, whatever you got. The conjunction of the two is of utmost importance, but does not trump the importance of structure. So what I was thinking last week and kind of mauling on is, for you guys that have been listening forever, or you've listened to Structure Masterclass 1, the Masterclass 2, you've read Next Level Musky Fishing, you kind of got your feel, you understand the basics of it, right? What are we looking at that really matters? Now, Jay, how many times have you heard the phraseology, the terminology, spot on spot?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Important in musky fishing, absolutely. Well,
and that's one of these things, like, I figured out the spot on spot. It's not that somebody shows you that. They wax eloquent about it at the ramp, right? We had the spot on spot. Okay, what matters there? And all week long, I've been catching fish. I've been doing this, doing that, blah, blah, blah. And really paying more attention to that where... And looking at my maps, and allow me a moment of latitude, which is I'm trying to look at what I've done for decades and where I'm catching fish and what is the commonality, right, Jay? Now, we might all have a point with a rock and this and that and the other where, like, you know, we 1 + 1 + 1 = 3, and it's musky money, right? Mm-hmm. The commonality of structure across everything I've fished between Tennessee and Canada, which is the entire habitat range, and I've done Washington, and I've done New York. So not a lot. I've not had a boat on. The places that have been dynamically far more important than anything else have been the beginnings and ends of things, Jay.
Okay.
What does that mean? The start of or the finish of. And I really looked at my maps. I looked at the maps this week where I went, all right, where's the waypoint? And you go, waypoint 596. Okay, and I look back at my records, and I put that in my fish finder, you know, 6 years ago for a catch, and that was on the very end of a point, and that was with rubber. Or I look at the beginning of a hump or the backside of a hump or the front side of a hole in a river or the backside of a hole in a river. What I'm starting to see emerge is the beginning point and the terminating point of structure tends to be the most dominant, right? So if we find, say, a littoral zone that's facing an open basin and it rises up slightly, the outside edges tend to be more productive than the inside edges until we get to the downstream. So let's say, like a normal human being, I fish out of the port side of my boat, Jay, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And we're going through a bay, and we come up to the top of a littoral zone. I'm expecting to see a fish there, and we might go through this section, say it's 100 yards long, and we get to the downside, right, where it drops back off. That's where I'm expecting fish. The beginning and ends of structural anomalies across the board for me have been the most productive. Where I think innately I gravitate towards those without knowing it, right? Where instead of barging into a flat or barging into a structural thing, I work my way into it because I assume the front side and the back side or And not front or back, don't get me wrong. What I'm saying is like where my first cast hits change and where my last cast goes back, whatever it is, where, okay, let's conceptualize this, if you will,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
We're all looking at the port side of our boats, which is the left side of your boat, okay? And we're going down a shoreline. And the shore, the water is 15 feet deep.
Okay.
But in the middle of this pass, it rises to 10 feet like a lopped off pyramid. So there's a rise from 15 to 10, and then it's even. It drops off from 10 to 15, right, Jay?
Like okay. Yep.
Up, flat, down. I expect to find fish between the point where it goes from 15 to 10 more so than I do to find fish on the flat 10 in the middle. So the transitional areas are far more important based on my records than the central sections of changes.
Gotcha. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
I'm thinking about where neighbor Steve keeps his boat. Think about that. We've done that a million times. We've made that pass and done it on the north side of that lake, the exact same scenario. Outside edge, central, we might get one outside edge. So from left to right, if we're running port, you know exactly the bay I'm talking about. Not where neighbor Steve keeps his boat, but the other structural anomaly and weed bed up there, right?
Yeah.
We smack them on the outside edge. We might pick one out in the center, and we smack them on the other downside. Transition zone, maybe one or two in the middle, transition zone. That's where we catch our fish. I'm finding that from looking at as many waypoints I could stand to funnel through and catches, that the majority of my structural catches are on transitions and the sections where change is taking place far more than the structural element itself. Kind of God smacked over it, right? Leading into a point, not the top of the point. Leading into an edge, not the plateau of an edge or a rise. So, paying special consideration to me becomes highly important to transitional zones and the sections most people overlook, Jay. They motor up to the flat, right? You motor up right till the weeds come up to the top. That's what most people do. Well, this is a flat and the weeds start here. Well, if we're coming out of depth, guess what? And we always are, unless it's just like just a shallow nothing. There's a transition, whether it be from left to right or whatever, however you're approaching it, right? From the open basin forward or whatever. There is a transition of depth to shallow. The transition seems far more important than the plateau. Does the plateau make sense for what I'm conceptualizing here?
Mm-hmm. It does, yeah.
Right. So we've all find ourselves where yeah, muskies are in the whatever, you know, they're in the muck or whatever. Jay, you put a picture up of early season muskies, right? And I remember that fish very well. And we're throwing small blades, right?
Yep.
That is on the outside edge of a creek channel. Correct me if I'm wrong. In a tiny bay.
Yep. Yeah, you're right.
Dead right. There is a cast to the left and a cast to the right that could be shallow flats. That fish and the fish I've caught in that come off the edge of that channel. They don't come on the deep part. They don't come on the shallow part. Somewhere in between of the transitional channel. And I'm talking a matter of, Jay, how deep is that water? 5 feet?
Yeah.
It's not
yeah.
deep.
The deep edge leading in, the creek channel leading in is like 9. And then that thing, yeah, I mean, you can get up to 2. But yeah, yep, everything's 4 feet. Four feet.
Right. And you go, huh, here's this weedy bay. Yeah. And I thought about that this week. I was going like, what matters? And when you start thinking about fish, you go, holy crap. Now, your fish in particular, right, you go, huh, did that matter? Yeah, I've done it like 10 times back there. Dr. Bob and I have been there. I've been there with MG. I've been with a bunch of different people in that exact same cove, right? All of them come somewhere in that vicinity. I've caught a dink off the edge or whatever, but there's merit to that. Where am I going to focus my energy when it matters is what I'm getting at, right? We can comb and we can, you know, we can cover as much water as possible. But when the rubber meets the road, where am I going to pay attention? Let's say that place, right, Jay? We go mm-hmm. and we have a pizza and you bet me $1,000 and you go, you got 10 casts to catch a muskie. 10 casts for $10,000, right? Every one of them's going down the side of that channel. Every one of them. Versus throwing in to the shallows. Now, it's not shallow versus deep. It is structure anomaly in a shallow zone. That is the zone of change. Correct me if I'm wrong. Explain that scenario, Jay. I'm not saying articulate it the way I articulate it. Explain that bay without spot burning and explain what we're seeing and explain what's happening there multiple times.
Yeah, it's a 50-acre bay. It's being fed by a creek. There's emergent and submergent vegetation. There's a creek channel leading into it with a neck down area, and then it widens out into this bay. And yeah, follow the creek channel and the weeds kind of lay off the structural anomaly you're talking about. The weeds grow to about 4 feet, so that 4 to 5 feet, boom, it's where all the mature fish are. And they're in there quite often. And they're in there using that bay because there's ample food source, I imagine.
Right.
They're not being overly harassed, and they're using that in the bright sun.
Well, same thing. Last time we went to Minnesota, so we fished, it comes up, it flattens out, we go across it and drops down, right?
Yeah.
If we're going port. Beginning and end. Think about it. In your head for a second.
Just did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Spots I fish all the time where they're flats, they're break-offs. It is, yes, we will pick up fish in the midsummer, in the peak of summer, in the dead middle of things. The same like with that shallow bay we just discussed, right, Jay? When we begin that pass on the north end, and there's a point in the middle that subdivides it, right? So think about that. We go to the north end of that thing, and there's a wee bed that goes left to right, because I always run port, so just for argument's sake. So we're in the north end of that lake. We will tag a fish at the beginning of that pass. Jim got a really good one year. Remember that on the outside weed edge?
Yep.
Then we might hit one on the point because there's a point that subdivides the weeds. And then we get to the other end and we tag fish. The beginning and end of structure and cover tends to be dominant. Now, for years, I've heard guys talk about mapping weed beds. Right? That used to be an old thing I used to hear all the time. Guys would literally spend half a day on Eagle Lake when I was a kid, finding the edges of weeds so they could target them with eagle tails, Jay. Right?
Yeah, right.
Well, they would pick up fish on the outside edge of things. But what I'm seeing is what's dominant is the marriage between cover, structure, and edges. Right? And at a certain point, that allows a muskie to ambush in or ambush out, right? So if we have a change in depth in combination, so we have a topography change, meaning a change in depth, in conjunction with cover, in conjunction with warm water, what are we missing? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'm looking at my catch records. I've never really addressed it this way, and I'm pontificating in real time to the best of my ability, where leading into a point in even the cold months where I talk about in the book, Jay, the terminating place for a point in the main basin, right? What that is where a point becomes one with the basin. You can no longer distinguish the point from the area around it, right? Is money, absolute money in the cold water period, wherever that mid break is, wherever the cover starts. So, you know, muskies are a shallow water edge animal, right? If you the surface is an edge, the bottom is an edge, but structure provides an outside edge, especially in summer months. And I think what I've missed, admittedly so, is not the propensity to be in cover, but to be on the transition adjacent to cover. And that's what hit me in the head this week. So hear me out again, because you know that channel I'm talking on, that small lake, right? There's a place on Eagle Lake where I have caught scuds of big fish, scuds of them. And I always thought that had to do with the cabbage. And I looked at the topography and I did a live image of it. Holy crap. They're not coming off the edge of that. They're coming off the edge of the channel for things that are entering and exiting that cover. Right? So, in some capacity, it's not about cover as cover for the muskie. It's about exploiting the fact that muskies know other fish use cover. Whoa, right? So I've said it before, and it's sometimes you have thoughts, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. I'm trying to realign how I think about it. So a walleye, Jay, is a hunter. Can we agree on that?
Yeah, sure.
That's a predator.
They are.
So how does a hunter hunt a hunter? He knows where he's going to be to hunt his prey. Right? Literally the movie Predator, right? So we're going to do, a walleye is hunting smaller bait fish and a muskie's hunting walleye. And he knows what a walleye is going to do based on what they do. And the walleye knows what he's going to do based on what he's eating, a perch or whatever it is. So down the food chain, how they establish their positioning is a direct corollary to what's conducive to their feeding. And when you think about the amount of fish you will pull out of outside edges, I've heard it for years. I'm not talking about, oh, I had this idea that fish the outside edges of weeds. Bullshit. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the structural outside edges might be far more important than even the edges of cover. Right? Because who's to say you threw it a weed bed and your boat is positioned, for example, Jim Stewart's big fish a couple years ago on that same lake I'm talking about, right, Jay? There's the weed edge. Remember that comment? Yeah, it's in a video.
Yep.
There's the weed edge. Halfway back, if not three quarters of the way back, he gets smoked. Was that fish on the weed edge or was it on the outside edge expecting things to come in and out of that weed bed? You see what I'm saying?
Totally.
And what I'm seeing as far as my record keeping is I'm pulling fish out of edges, but am I pulling out the structural edge or the cover edge per se? Now, we've all thrown up to shallow weeds and smoked a muskie or thrown a suic or thrown a titan or thrown something or a topwater, right? In the dead of summer. Forget what I'm saying. Late June, July, and August. Forget it. But when we get cold edges and we get things that slacken down, right, everything kind of slides off. So if a muskie doesn't want to be up in the slop, where's he going to be, Jay? The structural anomaly leading in, leading out, or adjacent to cover until that cover is gone or non-productive. And what I'm getting at, and I really thought about, I was going, what matters? Like, I've always heard for years, good boat positioning catches more muskies, or this, that, and the other catches more muskies. So what I'm conceptualizing is this, is the things I've said for years, which is back off, go low and slow in cold fronts, right? We're throwing at weed edges or edges or the bathymetry, the topography of a body of water, for whatever that's worth. We're throwing at the structure, but by going low and slow, are we contouring specifically the outside edges, more importantly than the tight edges? Right? That's the question. And I personally think that it is there's a modicum of willy-nilly who gives a rat's in the summer months, right, Jay? Throw blades over slop, over weeds, forget about it. But that is 1/4 of a year. So 3 months is 1/4, right? The rest of the time, we need to be far more focused on the structural connectivity to feeding zones than we need to be to the cover that we're relating to, because the cover is a mutual safe space for all predators. Which is, I was looking at, like, when do I catch muskies off of reefs in Canada, Jay? Low light periods in the evening. Guess why? Because walleyes are coming up. For the majority of the time. I've caught some middayers. I've caught this. You always have things that are on the outside of the curve, right? But muskies are staged in anticipation of a fish one notch down the food chain. Right? So how does the entire food chain stage? Well, in cold fronts, everything backs off. Right? And it's one of these things. I was thinking about this. So, imagine, if you will, dig, if you will, this collar, Jay.
Mm-hmm.
And heal yourselves in the waters of Lake Minnetonka.
Lake Minnetonka.
Right. Dig, if you will, this picture. So, and this is stupid, but allow me the latitude.
Sure.
So me, you, Fred, and Tom, we all hold hands and stick our arms out, right? We're like hands across America, like idiots. Well, and Tom's touching the wall of the muskie shop. There's four grown men touching the wall of the musky shop. So it goes, Tom, Fred, me, you. And we're going from right to left here, folks. So Tom is touching a wall on your right-hand side. Four grown men with their arms extended, fingers interlocked, because they're not afraid to express love. So Tom's touching the wall. Tom is a minnow. Right? Fred is a crappie.
Ooh.
I am a walleye. You are the warrior, Pat Benatar. You're a muskie. Right? Sure. So we're all out here. We're holding hands, arm extended. Right? The two smaller guys are closer to the edge, and it gets bigger as we go. So Tom, Fred, me, Jay, our arms are interlocked. As Tom wants to back away from that wall, we all back away in a commensurate distance. Think about that. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, okay.
If we're interlocked. Now, sometimes we will fold because it becomes easier. Right? We truncate the food chain. But in general, what I'm seeing from looking at 30 freaking years and notation and pontification is the food chain moves at a commensurate distance, Jay. So if our arms are outstretched, we've interlocked fingers because we're completely comfortable. It's 2024, right? And maybe me and Jay cuddle, maybe we don't. We move off the edge together at the same distance. We move in together. You see what I'm saying here? Do you see where I'm going with this, Batman?
As yeah, the food chain's locked in.
It's
of course
locked,
it is.
It's locked in a proximity. So Dr. Bob wrote an article. Hold on.
Ouch. You get shocked?
No, I was just making noise because I'm dumb.
Oh.
So Dr. Bob, God bless him. He's not a real doctor and his real name's not Bob.
Close enough.
Hold on. I asked him what his real name was. He said Bob stands for Babes on Board, Jay. But he's a real doctor. Kidding. He's a real doctor.
Okay.
So there's this article on the app that says the muskie's environment, right? And he's touching on what we've talked about in the past, which is light angles and how far things subtend, right? And what a muskie's visual range is. Okay? So from a logical standpoint, what I'm talking about is this entire hands across America, this food chain moving as one. Well, guess what? Muskies innately know the distance they need to be from their prey to be successful. So do walleye, so do perch, so do panfish. So everything moves as a grid, in and out. The ebb and flow is the ebb and flow. It hit me like a brick this week, Jay. The ebb and flow of shallow, mid to deep is commensurate and measurable and marked and even. At a certain point, everything's up ends up on the bottom, right? And their distribution between dead bottom and up on the bank is always an even endeavor. The more stable it is, the tighter they get. The more awful it is, the tighter they get to the bottom. So stability and awful are great because we know exactly where they are. The ebb and flow of daily weather, barometric pressure, frontal movements dictate the distances between these two points in space. Right? So bait fish are at 8, muskies are at 15. Bait fish are 1 foot. You see what I'm saying? It's just like you'll find this distribution that makes sense. Everyone's doing their job, right? So muskies are gatekeeping the outside edges. Walleyes are coming up at night. Perch are doing what they do. Everyone is doing their job in the ecosystem. And they move and flux based upon those frontal movements, those seasonal movements. So in the winter, that seasonal movement is smaller on tighter lines. In the summer, it's broader in shallower bays. And it really makes sense when we talk about how have I been successful, how you've been successful, how Booker's been successful in tough conditions. What do we do? Low and slow and big cast and far off a structure. Well, why does that work? Well, there's nothing up on the first 15 feet of the bank. There's nothing there because the bait fish have cut it off at 10 and the walleye have cut off at 15 and the muskie caught it off at 20. And the next day, things are better and everything shifts up, shifts up, shifts up. And there's an hour of chaos where everything's up shallow and it shifts off, shifts off, shifts off.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Mama's got a squeeze box. Daddy never sleeps at night.
Nope.
Right?
Restless.
So it's truncated, it's squeezed in the morning, it expands during the day, and it squeezes at the night in the summer if things are perfect. Make sense?
Who?
Who? Yeah. Who? Anyway, that's just the way I'm conceptualizing right now. Maybe I suck.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, when I say that, you know, deep water is a refuge for muskies, blah, 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 blah. It's this grid, like I said, that stupid example of Tom, you know, frickin' Fred, me and Jay, and we're shifting together as a group, right? All right, Tom wants to go deeper, so Fred's going to shift down, so I shift down and Jay shifts down. And then we go in, then we go out, we go in, we go out. It's the, I don't know, I'm trying to beat it in my own head. To be honest with you guys, because it's a different concept. And there's some people going, this guy's dumber than hell. Say it, Jay. Steve Paul sucks.
Mm-mm.
Dumber than hell. Anyway, here's my concept. It's not a tidal movement of water. It's a climactic, conditional, seasonal tide of predation.
Tide of predation.
Which is my band. We are tide of predation. Where things move in, things move out. Right? And it hit me. I was thinking about, like, somebody asked me, okay, what's this solar lunar crap, right? And he asked me, as barn swallows, wherever the heck they are pounding bugs off the top of the water, right? Mm-hmm. I go, it is the start of the food chain where, you know, aquatic insects or terrestrial insects are hatching based on timing and everything matriculates down the food chain and muskies make a move, right? Read the book. That's my take on it, where solar lunar things are happening that time out the ebb and flow of nature, whereas the shifting of things is a moving focus, because with live imaging, what I've been saying, I'm just blowing my mind, which is like speed is little of a, I hate to say this. I screwed up and probably missed thousands of fish by going too slow in bad conditions. I did. Depth and speed, deep presentations do not necessarily have to be slow in bad conditions. They just have to be below the level of light penetration, right? So the game becomes, what's the level of light penetration that the baseline, the core of the food chain's willing to be in? I'm seeing it, and I've seen it this spring. Bug hatches on great-looking days, great-looking musky days, Jay. Guess where they're happening? Super shallow edges. Crappy days like today, guess where they're happening? 15 feet offshore. You know? And I'm seeing the birds, and I'm watching these birds, and they're predating, and it sort of hit me like an idiot. I went, well, I bet you everything's behind me. Because the bugs are popping off 15 feet off the edge, and the birds are predating there. Yesterday, when we caught a monster shallow, that was happening in the shallows, right?
Sure.
What does it matter? We've talked about barometric pressure has little to no bearing. If you want to come on and debate me on that, bring it. I can pop my ears and eat a sandwich or a freaking pierogi on any plane there is, and a muskie can do the same. They're not going to starve to death because barometric pressure influences them negatively. Bullshit, right? So as the food chain shifts, are we shifting our approach, our presentations, and augmenting them to the appropriate depth? So yesterday it was Magnus prototypes, right? At mid-depth, burnt, which is a big swim bait I'm working on. Today, it was as much weight I could get on Magnus, burnt 25 feet further off the edge. Right? So instead of the food chain being shallow and littoral, the food chain started on the very edge of the littoral zone into the contact points of the main basin. And that's what I'm getting at. Beginning points and end points. So the very tip of the iceberg might end at the shoreline and end with the muskie at 25 feet. You see what I'm saying, Jade? Is that, am I just ruining the show?
Say the last one again. What was the last one?
The tip of the iceberg, right? Being zooplankton, photoplankton, whatever the hell you got. The very core of a food chain.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Might be on the shoreline.
Sure.
But the bottom of the pyramid, right? Right. Or flip it around, however you want to look at it. The top and bottom tiers of the food chain have a distance. Right? So if there's a bug spawn on the extreme edge, the muskies are on the outside edge. They might truncate during that weird summertime, but the vast majority of the time, there's a spacing between the food chain. Muskies don't want to get up where the bugs are hatching to scare off all the perch that the walleyes are bringing in that the muskies intend to eat. Think about that.
Yeah.
Right? If muskies want to eat walleye, they're not going to circumvent the other two stages of the food chain.
Right.
It's not smart. Now, they're not smart creatures, but they have eons of programming or divine creation, however you want to look at it. They're not dummies. They're really good at what they do. Right? Which is like Jay wants to go get some freaking pasta at Spang's. Well, guess what you don't do? Slash your own tires and go, why can't I get there? Whoa, my tires are gone. Who did that?
Right.
A muskie doesn't run up and pick off the 2-inch minnows that are eating the freaking bug hatch that the perch are eating that the walleye are eating. It's the truncation of the food chain. Anyway, I don't know shit.
Interesting.
Yeah, whatever, I'm right. That makes sense? Yeah. Have I lost my mind? Have I thought about it too much?
You got to figure that any part of the food chain is not going to sabotage it to make things more difficult.
They just don't
play that way. They're not wired that way.
That's
They're
what
wired
I'm saying.
To survive.
Like, fish aren't wired to cheat.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm just watching it. I've spent way too much time on a boat. I mean, I said it before we redid it. I had to up my captain's license. Like, oh my goodness, the amount of time I spent on a boat is just vulgar. And you watch it, and you watch where muskies come from, and you go, okay, super shallow, not so shallow, outside edge, inside edge. Why does it change every day? And I'm watching these birds. I'm going, that's the absolute, whether, you know, you make your little Illuminati pyramid with your fingers, that's the food pyramid, whatever. Whether you call it the top or the bottom or whatever it is, where that line is, where that edge is, everything is commensurately staged to it. So when let me put it this way, right? Yesterday, I said it before, but these barn swallows or whatever the heck they are, they're feeding Jay in the muck right off 6 inches of water, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we get up there and we're making 40-foot casts to the very outside edge of a weed bed, schmackety wackety monster trophy in the net, right? Wonderful. Well, guess what I try to do? Let's do the same thing today, right? I go, well, the birds are behind me. What am I doing? Back it off the same distance, if not a tick further, and guess what we start seeing? We start seeing muskies. So there is
that's cool.
And here's my thought. Everybody can, whatever, mark it on your calendar because a bunch of people are going to think I'm dumb. There's the bottom of the lake. There's the surface of the lake. There's the edges of the lake. There's a light edge of the lake, right? So we got bottom, side, surface, light penetration. The fifth edge is bait penetration. Where is the bait stage in the lake? At the baseline of your forage base is the fifth edge. Where bait begins is your fifth edge. When you explore the structure adjacent to that is where you find muskies. I will go down swinging on this one. I'll fight you tooth and nail. Which is, we've always said there's four edges. Well, actually three, right? So you got bottom, side, and surface. Me and Herbeck have always talked about light penetration. Beautiful. The fifth edge is the food chain edge. Is that commensurate to the surface edge, light penetration? Once you understand where those five edges are, now you know where it begins and the process goes in or out. So once we understand, so side, top, surface, light, forage edge, now we can work our ways back to where the apex predator is, who's going to be in the outside edge, exploiting fish that are coming into this bait edge that's influenced by light, surface, side, and bottom. That, I think, is where I'll shut up and we'll do Q&A.
There you go.
All right, Jaybird David. What do you think about fish attraction sprays like garlic or shad or some of the other flavor? Dr. Juice.
The juice is loose.
If you ain't juicing, are you even trying? What do you think, Jay? Are you a juicer?
Well, don't get caught juicing. That's what I'm saying. Do it in secret on the side.
Yeah, you got to be like Barry Bonds. Don't.
No, we've talked about it a little bit before. I mean, I don't think it can hurt. If you got a bottle of Dr. Juice, try some on there. It's going to mask human odors and bug spray and suntan lotion, whatever else, you know, mayonnaise on your sandwich and all that stuff. So
I wouldn't. Here's the deal. We've talked to Andrew Walker in the past. Some of these people where cold water scent matters, warm conditions, it doesn't seem to matter. Booker did a thing where he was dipping bucktails in gas and sunscreen and peed on them and all this different stuff, and it didn't affect them. But I don't believe like a slow, super slow presentation is going to benefit from a bad smell, right? Now, I've seen people in Canada where they're taking walleye guts and dipping their bulldogs in them overnight, and they swear by it, right?
Okay.
So to each their own, I try to avoid, you said sunscreen. It's a couple things, right? Number one, bug spray will stain the plastic on your electronics. So if you spray off or anything with DEET in it, the black plastic in your electronics is going to get little white speckles on it.
Yep.
So I avoid that. Number two is sunscreen. I attempt to not get it on my hands. I don't want it on my hands because at a certain point, that stuff is waterproof, sweatproof, and it's probably a negative impact at the end of the day, right? For lack of a, I would hate to like put sunscreen on my hands, grab a bait, throw it out, and miss a fish of a lifetime. You're going, was it the sunscreen or wasn't it? At least be at a baseline or a neutral. I don't think in the summer months, sin is going to help you. Maybe during cold water periods it's a benefit, but if you're using sunscreen or you're doing this or you're doing that, it can't hurt. Some people swear by it, some people don't. I'm kind of chaotic neutral on it. You know, if I'm using something to block the sun or bug spray, a scent's not the worst thing. Jay, you can always be juicing, they say.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe, you know, like you're right, in the colder water periods or in cold front periods where the fish are a little bit, where you're slowing down and they're giving a little bit more thought and effort into, you know, identifying what they're about to eat, you know, maybe it would have a better impact. But
Well, it's
when they're
like,
just, you know, flat out reactive, you know, when
no, when
most
they're
people catch
flying
their
around,
fish,
yeah, when they're
yeah,
flying around
I doubt
fast,
it.
yeah. I mean, back in the day, I used to think about, here we'd stop our boats, right? You'd stop your big old Mercury Blue Band when I was doing it, or my Yamaha, and there's a little rainbow behind your boat of oil from your exhaust, and you go, is that good or bad? I mean, that was just the nature of a two-stroke. There was a little rainbow behind the boat.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's I don't worry about it tremendously. However, cold water period, when I think about it. Greg, hey man, love the show. I was wondering, as a fellow music lover, what you think about listening to music while fishing. Would it always spook them? Could the vibration possibly get their attention? Jay, what is a muskie's favorite song?
Probably any old AC/DC.
I would say that
They
or
like to rock.
for those about to fish, we salute you.
True.
Muskies,
Thunderstruck, you know, oncoming, you know, storms rolling in. I mean, gotta forget about
they're also massive Billy Squire fans.
Right,
I
right.
found that, I would rather have a Billy Squire record on than Dr. Juice.
Sure.
Stroke me,
Stroke
stroke
me,
me.
stroke me. Right.
Exactly. That's it. It doesn't matter. We pound around in the boat. When you're talking in the boat, it resonates into the water. If they were spooky, or if you're on really spooky fish, don't have music on. Your trolling motor's doing enough chaos down there, making enough commotion. I wouldn't worry about it. Jason, his favorite Muskie song is 5 Minutes Alone by Pantera, I believe you said.
No.
Anyway, Jim wants to know, is the Christmas tree color still available from Booker or Booker Tail Tinsels? I don't know. Do you know, Jay? You're the bait man.
I
Christmas tree
think
color.
I believe the black chartreuse is nicknamed Christmas tree. So anything color 15, which is black chartreuse,
Color
would be Christmas
15.
tree.
There you go. So if you and they offer that in what?
501s, 701s, 851s, lots.
There you go. So if it's color 15, black chartreuse, that is Christmas tree. Oh,
Oh,
Christmas
Christmas tree.
tree.
Yeah.
AJ, can you guys talk about the Livingston Looters bulldozer? It looks a lot like a Super Shad Ramp, which is a bait I love throwing, but the ramp are super cheap and delicate, and they fall apart all the time. How is the bulldozer comparable? Thanks for making the podcast every week. We try, AJ. So I was not involved on that bait. That's before my tenure with them. It is very similar to a shad wrap. It works very similar to a shad wrap. It's hard plastic and indestructible. That's all I'll say. So it's a shad wrap that just won't break. Not my cup of tea. It's
And a little
fun.
bigger.
Again, slightly. I'm not say again. I'm not big into just cloning. It's a good bait. Don't get me wrong. Check one out. It'll do you well. Donald. Okay, he wants to know about the Picey Fun Reels, Jay. Dom wants to know about these Picey Fun Reels. I've heard a bunch about these. I've heard mixed bags from. I have some clients that are great anglers that love them. Some people at the bottom that hate them. We don't carry them. It's not the worst thing ever that we don't have them. They sell direct to consumer, and they sell direct from China via Amazon. And that's it. That's not a knock. That's a flat fact, right? It is an inexpensive reel. I would say when I've looked at reels that are not Daiwa, Shimano, Abu Garcia, dominant companies, pin, whatever they might be, they become disposable. You can't repair them. And once they break, they're just done. And user experience seems to vary with those. Right, we've looked at these before. We've looked at budget reels. You look at this, you go, okay, if we buy 1,000 of them, how many are coming back? I'm not gonna say the number, but you look at it and you go, there's good ones, there's bad ones, there's everything in between. I'm not gonna say don't do it. I'm not gonna say do it. I'm just gonna go, Be prepared. You might have a great one. You might have a bad one. You might have a wonderful experience. I know guys, one guy that likes those reels I'm thinking of right now, dude had problems with Shimano and went to those. He's like, I love these reels. And he had, I don't have problems with Shimano's.
Mm-mm.
But he did. And he's like, cool. It's a cool reel. I mean, a reel's a reel's a reel. Does it turn the line? Does it do it effectively? And is it drag good? That's it. So whatever that looks like to you, I'm not going to say it's good. I'm not going to say it's bad. I'm just saying if you were to get a bad one, your user experience might be far worse than somebody that gets a good one. More on that later. You know, it's one of these deals where it's such a wild, wild west thing. Who knows where that will end up? Kyle, where should I look? Where should I start looking for places to perform my 3-point check when I launch my boat? So if you don't know what a 3-point check is, I talk about next level musky fishing where we look for bait fish, shallow, mid, deep, which kind of riffs on the crazy rant I went on earlier about where a bait fish stage and where is the food chain. You're going to look at structural elements. Is it cover structure? What matters in your lake? We're going to find dominant cover structure primarily, shallow. Then we're going to find dominant cover slash structure mid. And then we're going to find dominant structure deep, right? Outside the littoral zone. So find you a shallow, mid, and deep zone that perennially have bait fish. You might have to drive around the lake and go, wow, there's always bait fish here. Wow, there's always bait fish here. You're not going to do it in one afternoon, right? Be observant at all times. Amanda, what's up with the overarching male names for musky lures? They seem a little misogynistic. Showgirls, cowgirls, slightly sexist. Whoa.
Slightly?
Slightly. Yeah. Jay. I'll let you, man, we don't pre-screen. What do you think, Jay?
Well, yeah, it's part of the tongue-in-cheek humor of the it's always been. That's just history. And
it's history, yeah. Right, Jay?
We've made fun at that a little bit, you know, with some PG rated made up names, and we've gone further in the car rides before.
Yeah. It is, man.
If you remember back.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah, Margie. Oh yeah, Margie.
Some knee slapping fun nary.
Unguith. Amanda, thank you for listening. Yes. Fishing has always tended to be misogynistic. I apologize for that. My wife is a great angler. She was actually out on the water today. It just, let me put it this way. Don't give a man an opportunity to name something close or near a phallus. That's just the nature of the game, boys. I mean, I'm sorry. It just is what it is. You know,
well, yeah, I mean, look at Jody Michael. I mean, she didn't name her boat the Big Johnson. She named the Gray Squirrel.
Oh, you're an idiot, you know? Jay. You're going to get in trouble. No. She's got to read the transcript and you're in a world of hurt. Mm-hmm. No, it's I'm not a matter. Saying, yeah. I don't think it's a matter of, let me back it up as a representative for the male musky faction. I don't think it's a matter of misogyny. It's a matter of reverence and appreciation. Anything else, fly, Jay?
Yeah, well, okay. It's a good attempt.
And we're trying. Derek.
I'm buying it.
Anyway, it just is what it is. Boys are idiots. I don't think anything means any harm. I don't think at this point, I'm not trying, again, I'm not political. I'm like the most neutrally political person there is. I don't care. I don't have time for it. But I don't feel like there's anybody in the musky industry that's trying to be offensive, right, or derogatory. So if there's something you find that is towards a gender, take it as a compliment. Right? It's not a matter of negative positive. It is a adoration. And that's why I would look at it right now. I most of these people are really good people, and it just is what it is. And you come up with a dumb name and you call it is what it is. Derek, how do you deal with wind during summer months? Nose in, nose out. How do you control your drift? Jay, that's a loaded question. It could go any way, Derek. So, depending on how you're fishing, what you're fishing. So, wind in your drift is going to dictate how you address it. So, let's say we're in a cold front and we need to get off the deep edge like we're talking about, or we need to go low and slow, whatever that might look like, right? Well, slow presentations are hard in a quick drift, right? So are we going to spot lock, and is the bait going to be carried away? Is it going to be carried up from us, away from us, towards us? We've got to think about two things at one time. How do I control my boat to the best of my ability where it does not negatively impact my presentation? So boat control and presentation. So if it's a straight retrieve bait and it gets behind the boat, let's say we're throwing bucktails and they get behind the boat, Jay, right? And the boat's moving forward because of the drift. Guess what happens? They rise. If we're drifting towards a bait, we have more slack line to contend with. So all we need to think about is this. Boat control is a secondary consideration to what presentation we're attempting to do. Right? If we're ripping and pulling rubber, we might advance towards the bait and just pick up the line quicker. Well, we know, okay, it's got this rate of fall. I'm back at it. I'm really into it. Where we don't want to drag baits and lift them. We don't want to go towards baits and run them too deep. We want to make sure our boat is not negatively influencing our running depth.
Absolutely.
Secondly, is we want to make sure our boat control allows us to competently cover an area. So we talked about how musky see, musky smell, musky feel, all this stuff. Well, in the grand scheme of things, in typical lighting considerations, they'll subtend just a very short distance. So we don't want cast landing 100 feet apart. So you've got to look at your boat control from a matter of this. Is it a matter of I do this drift multiple times, or is it a matter I do this drift one time with utmost control, but it doesn't negatively affect my baits? Or do I do this drift 30 times because I'm drifting 6 miles an hour because the wind's blowing this way, but I can still work my bait appropriately? How you do it doesn't matter. What matters is how your boat control influences your presentation and the spacing of your presentations over structure your positive holds muskies. That's it. Right? It's a simple answer for a very complex question where you might need, I talked about last week, we use a drift sock in the Netherlands, right?
I was just going to say that. That's
yeah. And I'm bringing that back. There's one on my boat again. That was brilliant. Hadn't done that in a while. Or we're going to spot lock. Well, is spot locking causing my baits to rise because I'm holding? You've got to address all the factors. It is running depth, running depth, running depth, running depth, number one. What is my target zone? What is my target running depth? How is my current boat positioning, drift or lack of drift, influencing that positively or negatively?
Yeah, and check your speed. I mean, if you're going a half mile an hour or faster, it's more difficult to fish precisely and effectively. Well, just flat out is.
Yeah. Where you could, well, with that being said,
you could point your trolling motor into the wind and then, run it at half speed to slow down your drift. But again, that's an art form.
But let's say this. Let's say we got a mile and a half drift, right, from wind. That's clipping, right? Well, if muskies are tight to an edge, guess what? It's easy. Closer to the shoreline truncates the amount of cast. Short cast, bam, 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 right? You can't always make bomb casts. If you think about it, you have a mile and a half drift.
Mm-hmm.
Your casts are landing hugely apart from one another. Do we need to do this a million times over? Or do we tighten to the edge where you know muskies are at. Now you go, well, how do I know where that's at? Well, that goes back to structure fishing. That goes back to seasonality. It goes back to a million other factors. Let's just assume you know where they're at. If muskies are on an 8-foot break line and I've got a mile and a half drift, I know I need to be 3/4 of a decent cast off with 2 anglers.
There you go.
Or I can be further off with 3 anglers. It's coverage. So boat control becomes coverage. And people say good boat control catches muskies. What they're saying, and if you distill it down to the core of what really is being articulated, nobody ever articulates this crap because it's musky fishing. Good boat control means good casting control. Good casting control means coverage. Good coverage means good presentation, which means more musky strikes.
Yeah, and if you got 2 or 3 anglers in the boat and you're moving it, you know, can move faster. Fishing that well, yeah, pay attention where those casts are landing and fish the spaces.
I tell everybody in my boat, at this point, if our cast, I don't care if we got 3-4 people in the boat, if our casts are spaced more than 5 feet apart, we're going to tighten it up.
Mm-hmm.
I want 5-foot gaps. 3 days ago, Jay, we got 3 people throwing. I was actually in the back of the boat. And I ended up hooking a fish because the guy in the front and the guy in the middle kept leading. I said, bring them in, straight in, straight in, straight in. Well, they're providing 25-foot gaps. I'm going to go straight in working, straight in working. Front of the boat, back of the boat doesn't matter to me as much as good coverage, right? If muskies were incensed and losing their minds 100% of the time, it would always be a front of the boat, the first bait, the lands cast. We wouldn't be talking. We'd be like, guys, here's how you catch a muskie. Go out to the lake, throw the first cast, and turn the handle when you got him. End of podcast, episode 1, 5 minutes long. Right? Done. When in actuality, it is proper presentation, proper speed, proper depth of presentation, proper size of presentation, proper retrieve, proper angle of retrieve, proper relation to sun, proper relation to seasonality, blah, 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 blah. So why are we blaring through places where positive muskies are and where positive we had the right presentation on, but we're blaring through it, leaving 40, 50, 60-foot gaps between our casts?
It's not effective.
Something not at all. I've screamed for years. Not all of the fish are in front of the boat. When I fish, and Jay's done it, when you see me in a video standing in front of the boat, people go, why is the guy in the front of the boat? My main priority is to truncate casting angles. Guess who else did that, Jay? Joe Bucher. Joe Bucher got out of the front of the boat and he goes, it's got a guide cast and client cast. And people look at you like you're nuts. If I cut you off and tell you not to cast over me, I can control your coverage area. Right? I can make short little casts where people don't even realize you're doing it. That's the funny thing. Don't care. If you're an aspiring guy, think about this. Or say you've got a son or you got a friend, you were trying to get him a muskie. We're fishing weed. If I make casts that are not hitting the edge, but I'm bopping out there, I can control you. Because everyone wants to throw at some 45-degree angle away from the nose of the boat and show how far they can cast. Who cares? You can truncate the flow of a boat from the nose. When I'm in the back of the boat, I'm actually cherry-picking more when I'm in the back than when I'm in the front. Right? In the front of the boat, you're throwing a bait that might be a 10% odds, but you're slowing the pace with baits that are behind you that are high odds. And you're keeping people, don't cast past me, just throw straight in off yourself, square up to the gun of the boat, and throw straight ahead of you. If people are throwing straight ahead, they're covering more, and you can dictate the flow of the boat, opposed to you got people in the nose of the boat launching bombs that are hitting nothing. That's the way I look at it, is what's more important to me is, and I'm riffing like on the hierarchy, but let's just think about it. Okay, so how do we find a muskie? Okay, first and foremost, let's look at seasonality. Wonderful. So what seasonality are they in, and what depth does that seasonality dictate? Wonderful. That seasonality dictates X, Y, and Z depth. Therefore, it dictates these presentations. Great. At what speed are these presentations effective? Fantastic. What coverage and vibrational profile do those presentations have? Those dictate how fast we can move through an area. Right? Effectively. Now, weather influences that, and we have to augment our boat control to complement that hierarchy of needs or decisions. That's it. So how fast do we drift? How slow do we drift? What do we do for boat control? Answer all those questions, and then how you control your boat is a non-starter. You know exactly how you need to control your boat. Are my bulldogs getting behind my boat and rising in the water column? They need to slow things down with a drift sock or spot lock. Are my baits getting ahead of my boat? I need to drive faster and then cover this area multiple times to make sure I got absolute coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Is the wind pounding the shore I'm fishing? So instead of trying to parallel out, should I drift in and then come back out and restage and drift into the shoreline multiple times, right? Sideways? How you drive your boat is wholly dictated by the presentations and the seasonality you're trying to present. That's it. People go, I drive my boat like this. Well, guess what they do, Jay? They put that son of a gun on five all summer long and throw bucktails at a 45-degree angle in front of the boat. They get three-quarters of the way through. The blades lift. They come into their lousy figure eight, and they throw them again. And the winter comes, and guess what they do? The same thing. And if the wind's blowing, they crank it up, and they get this thing where all the baits end up behind the boat. So I want my bait, in a perfect world, thrown in front of myself at a slight. So if the center of my body's noon and I'm squared up with the gun, I might throw it at 1 o'clock, and it comes in at 11 or 12, slightly down from where I'm moving based on the drift or my trolling motor. And I come in for a very natural, controlled depth figure eight. Right? You've been on my boat where we're drifting into a spot and I'm constantly working the trolling motor in reverse to hasten our arrival, right? Or I'm working nose in, I'm working the boat backwards, where we're looking for the most natural presentation with controlled depth. What's the point of having a deep presentation? So this is what kills me. A crankbait starts shallow because it lands at the water. They're buoyant, most of them, right, Jay?
Yeah.
They land and they're shallow. They're floating. Throw a depth rotor, it hits the water, it floats. You crank it down, it starts getting depth. So the first 10% of the cast, we're working down to 75% of the running depth. And now for 25% of the cast, we're at max running depth. Now we're coming back up in a C shape. Now if the boat's dragging it forward, right? So we've made that cast and the boat's moving faster. As we're reeling up, the speed's increasing because it's physics. Where we're at, first where the bait's at, we're dragging the bait up now. So we have very little control of speed. And the only things we control in musky fishing are two things: speed and depth. Our boat dictates that heavily based on our relationship with cover and structure. And that is augmented nonstop by climactic conditions. Big wind, harder boat control, harder control your presentation. So, you know, Jay, we've seen it before together. You're in winds that are so rocking and rolling, the boat is bobbing up 4 feet. Well, guess what? You're losing on your casts. 4 feet. What do you do? Now, if you have a target depth of 12 feet and you're losing 4 feet from 4 foot rollers, which are scary, we need to add weight that gets us 4 more feet of depth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, the next time I fish 4-footers, I will be on my couch watching people do it. I'm never doing it again. But if you're bobbing up 2 feet regularly, guess what you got to do? Add lead or add weight that gets you 2 more feet of depth. Because the conditions on the surface are augmenting your running depth as much as your advancement or lack of advancement of how you're augmenting your baits. I see it so often where, Jay, the same lake we're talking about, neighbor Steve's place. We go behind a boat. I count the amount of casts they make. I can't imagine figure eighting with the boat on six.
Yeah.
You've seen it. Go through a space. Okay, the bait hits. Think about this. I'm just freaking down a rabbit hole today. Sorry. Bait hits. Boom. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. Most caster, I'm trying to think in my head. Let's call it a 25-second, 30-second presentation, right? So if 30% of 30 seconds is in where muskies need to be, you only have 10 seconds in front of fish. Think about that. How long is your retrieve, Jay, in most circumstances? You make a cast. Is it 30, 45 seconds that bait's out?
Yeah, probably.
So let's be generous. 45 seconds. Well, it hits the water and it's got to get to the running depth or be where you want it to be. It takes a few seconds. Let's shave 5. So you got 40. Right? And you hit running depth from second 6 to 25, and now your boat's dragging it up because your drift's incorrect. I mean, it's a percentage game. So if a 45-second cast and only 20% of it's in the zone where muskies are habitating or where they can see, so we're for only 10%, 20% of a 45-second cast, we are at the right structural depth, the right cover depth, we are at the right level of light penetration, the right edge of bait fish. How much are we effective throughout the course of the day? Super low number. You might make 1,000 casts, but let's say 1,000 casts are, 4,500 seconds. So for 900 seconds out of the day, I'm horrible at math. Let's say you make 1,000 casts, right? And they're 45 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, if 2/3 of your time is inefficient, ouch, you got to adjust.
That's what I'm getting at. Smart poker here. Anyway, Jay, I've ran my mouth. I've gone down the rabbit hole. I could sit here and just blast on forever. Some might say, right on, Jay. Right on.
You sure?
Right on. Anyway, guys, I will see you this coming weekend at Muskie Odyssey in Canada. Ooh. Monday. Me and Jay will do the podcast because I'll be out there drinking Pepsi with my Canadian brosips. Anyway, Jay Bird, say good night.
Night, everybody. Thank you.
Later. I want to tell you a story about a muskie I know. When it comes to big girls, she steals the show. Ain't exactly pretty. Ain't exactly a smile. 55, 36, 50 pounds. You can say she's got it all. Yeah.